Welcome back to Understanding VC. I'm your host Rahul. Today my guest is Joseph Macano. Joseph is a founding partner of Verge Health Tech Fund, a VC fund focusing on seed stage healthcare tech companies relevant to emerging markets. Prior to this, he was a scientist researching new cancer therapies, a medical device entrepreneur, and a management consultant for Oliver Wyman, where he led life sciences and digital health across Asia. Now let's talk to him. Hi, Joseph. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Cool. Thanks so much, Rahul, for having me and the opportunity to share my story.
So let's start with your story. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Romania. I spent my formative years in South Korea, where ironically, I learned how to speak both English and Romanian, and then spent the next 30 years in Canada, basically. I was, raised in a small town 2 hours east of Toronto, did my undergrad in Toronto, graduate school in Toronto, MBA, almost Toronto, 2 hours west of Toronto in London, Ontario. And then I suddenly went international in that, I worked in China, I studied a bit in Taiwan, I moved to Singapore in 2014, I've been here since, and I've had the opportunity to live or work in over 20 countries during my life. So I've been quite lucky, but it happened quite suddenly in the past 12 years or so.
Yeah, so what did you study in college?
So I studied molecular genetics and molecular biology in college, and I thought I wanted to be a scientist, so did medical biophysics for my doctorate. And then the business education came as a consequence of accidentally starting a medical device startup and realizing that you need to also understand a little bit of the business side as well.
Yeah. So did you take up a job, or was the startup your first job?
I'm not sure what is really considered my first real job. I almost feel like, my summer in private equity or management consulting might be my first kind of quote unquote real job, because at least there was like some sort of structure and order and having to deal with larger groups of people and different kinds of stakeholders. Because when I was doing my PhD, yeah, sure, I worked. Like I came to the lab every single day. I worked on experiments. I did have a team. I even managed some students. As a startup co-founder, I was still doing a lot of the execution work, but there was not a lot of structure because it was just a startup with, at the start, only two full-time people.
I understand your expertise in healthcare, but why start a VC fund specializing in healthcare?
Well, I would have really loved to have joined one, but I couldn't really find one that invested in the kind of things that I was really interested in and found important. And maybe I can take a step back and give a little bit of context into why healthcare, why investing, then why VC.
Yeah.
With why healthcare, when I was a young kid, I was kind of acutely aware of my own mortality and the mortality of others. And I was honestly quite terrified of the concept of getting old, getting sick, or even dying. So, it seemed natural to want to study something that would delay that or prevent it from happening altogether. So that's the healthcare piece of it. I got a real appreciation of just how challenging and how bad healthcare was when I moved to Singapore and I started to do work in emerging markets. And I saw like the numerous challenges that everyday people faced, and they didn't have to. And that was unfortunate. And during the course of this, I met some promising entrepreneurs who were trying to fix these problems, but they had trouble attracting capital. So this was really why I started getting really interested in investment, because I started, angel investing first by accident in one of my mentees, because she just asked me if I wanted to invest. And then I realized that actually, even these small amounts of money can actually make a big difference. And then when they realize their mission, it's extremely fulfilling and extremely impactful, because you have enabled, in a way, their dream of helping fix the problem that they want to dedicate their life, or at least dedicate the next, 5 to 10 years solving. And that was a whole lot more impactful than, I guess, what my day-to-day job was as a management consultant, making some PowerPoint slides. So then it dawned upon me that I should probably do this full time. But as an angel investor, you are spending whatever you're able to scrounge away from your job to this. So doing that full time is really difficult unless you've managed to scrounge away a whole large sum of money. So the next best thing is to use other people's money. And that comes to the area of venture capital. And the first, the search for it, and then lack of finding it, the need to start one.
Yeah. So the point that you made about, afraid of debt, I think a lot of people has acceptance to death or illness. And if a lot of people think that death is really unacceptable, I think the healthcare sector would progress a lot faster. Just like, this whole COVID situation and then how fast we came up with the vaccine.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And I think it's not so much of the acceptance of the concept of death, but rather the acceptance of its inevitability and the fact that we can't do anything about it. I think there are some cultural differences in how death is perceived, where you know, it is something to be feared or something to be embraced or something to be, acknowledged as the next step. And it would be interesting to see if we are able to make a meaningful difference in delaying the onset of aging or severe disease or death, whether these cultural differences would start to converge or whether they'd further diverge.
I read your LinkedIn summary, and then it really very nicely categorizes three areas of focus for healthcare, which is one is like the preventive part, where like you can keep measuring your body and to make sure that you stay healthy longer. And then when you have an issue, the ability to use data to reach a faster diagnosis, and then to find absolute cures for difficult health issues like maybe Alzheimer's. So could you talk about like these three things and what is happening right now in new healthcare techs?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that in terms of what we are seeing in the first two buckets, it's really quite exciting to see the proliferation of data and the acceptance of the greater use of data in everyday lives. I think the consumer wellness devices like the Fitbit, the Apple Watch, Garmin, that are shifting towards providing more and more clinical telemetry, the greater acceptance of telemedicine at home, the greater usage of health and wellness apps are certainly helping build awareness and, in a way, in a very fragmented way, getting people a bit more aware about their health. I think the challenge is all of this is quite fragmented. Some of this may not necessarily be clinical grade. They might not actually provide you the quality information and advice, which, could be potentially dangerous. But I think a lot of the information out there is so generic that, it should be okay. Yeah. It's like, sleep more, eat less, don't eat so much ice cream. And even simple behavioral things like that can make a difference. But what's interesting is the data that's generated by all these wearables can then give you a biofeedback loop that lets you know whether what you're doing is having a positive effect or not. And I think this gets more serious when you start looking at the management of chronic diseases, because then you have actually clinically prognostic biomarkers that can then be measured and managed through either medical or non-medical means. But again, having that feedback loop, so it's not just a one-way communication, and then having doctors increasingly know what to do with this information or increasingly aware of the platforms that are being used to present and manage these conditions. So that's exciting there. None of this is rocket science. All of this is incremental. And I can't think of anything that would be super breakthrough except for the non-invasive monitoring of blood biomarkers that would be otherwise very difficult to measure without taking a blood draw or a urine draw. I think that's the really exciting part, which we're starting to get on the cusp of solving. On the definitive cure part of things, there's the sci-fi stuff, which is like, how do we use stem cells to regrow new tissues? How do we use our immune system and train it against fighting cancers? How do we turn back the clock of aging, be it through restoring the methylation patterns, if you're a follower of David Sinclair, rebuilding telomeres, clearing out all the scar and fibrotic mess that accumulates in your tissues or the plaques in your arteries, all that sort of stuff. That's one part of it. And the other part of it, what's quite interesting, is the increasingly targeted nature of pharmaceuticals, where instead of going after broad effect or being a broad say, poison that targets, say, you know, just DNA division, and with cancer cells dividing faster than non-cancerous cells, you have a therapeutic difference. Now you actually are able to turn specific genes off and on. You're able to silence proteins. You're able to lock onto things. You're able to, you know, correct misshapen proteins, which is pretty interesting. So we're getting really, really precise with what we're doing, but it's also getting more and more expensive and more selective. So the idea of like the N of one trial is probably going to happen sooner or later. The other interesting thing is the avoidance of pharmaceuticals. Can you actually cure a disease entirely through lifestyle changes, entirely through a digital therapeutic, be it some sort of gaming routine or some sort of, you know, maybe it's mindfulness, maybe it's something else, or digital CBT? Like, that's really exciting. So when it comes to a definitive cure, pharma doesn't necessarily need to be the default answer. Yeah. And that's exciting. If I was pharma, I'd also be a little bit terrified.
Yeah. So, you know, the one, I mean, if I were to define the purpose of technology, the one definition that I really have is like to reduce the cost of products and services, you know. So this kind of approach really brings down the healthcare cost, right? You know, to making sure that, because finding absolute cure for a difficult health issues is expensive, and it's, and there is no way around it. The only thing that you can possibly do is like reduce by making health lifestyle changes. And
yeah, quite possible.
So you're a VC, let's talk about some fundraising. So one of the, you know, accessing investors and getting to a yes is always a challenge, right? So what would your advice be to a founder trying to raise capital?
I think you got to do your homework. First and foremost, I throw out 90% of the decks I get just because they didn't read what we do. I think that's step one. And I know that sounds kind of a little condescending, because like, how do you know what people are looking for? I think there's a certain element. I think there's also a bit of optimism maybe in that, you know, maybe, you know, I know that the VC says they'll invest in this, but maybe they'll make an exception for me, because by nature, founders are optimistic. Like if you're going to put aside a potentially very lucrative career and sacrifice a decade of stability to pursue a dream or an idea, you have to be somewhat optimistic. Yeah. Now, the problem is this optimism cuts both ways. So if you're optimistic about starting a company, you're also sometimes really optimistic about raising money. So you think, oh, I think I only need $1 million and I think I can raise it in 3 months. Whereas the reality is you might need $2 million and it might take you a year to raise it.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that will, maybe as a founder, you might want to run by your strategy and pressure test it with somebody who's a little bit more pessimistic to see, you know, is there a rose-tinted glasses correction that needs to be made in your ask and your timelines and your plans? And this is where, you know, sometimes a more conservative CFO type of co-founder can come in really useful, or an advisor. So doing your homework, being more realistic about your expectations of the raise. And I think the third thing is just tell a really good story.
Yeah.
Because the challenge is, look, by the time we dig into the product and service for due diligence, we've already had to have had a few meetings. So if we're not captivated and excited by your story, whether your solution is a million times better than what is out there right now, or whether you are solving such an earth-shaking problem, or maybe you'll make the investor 1,000 times their money. But there has to be some sort of story that resonates with the investor's motivations.
Yeah.
And I think the storytelling part of the pitch is very much underappreciated.
Yeah. So I read a blog post that you wrote, which talked about trust and relevance. And then in the trust part, you mentioned about, you know, doing this really well, because when VCs do due diligence, and then if they find competitor, then you look silly. So yeah, how do you think startups can do like a really good competitor deck?
I think a healthy dose of paranoia is there. And this is a very subjective thing. And I know that investors will have different preferences around this. Some investors just want a simple 2x2 and, you know, show your logos. Some investors want a super detailed chart, which, you know, tabulates every single feature. Personally, I like more detail than not. And I like a focus on not just your direct competitors, but who could be your competitors if they decided to do what you're doing today. And this idea of, you know, direct and indirect, I think is really important in a competitive analysis. And I don't need to see 20 names. Yeah, sure, due diligence, appendix, whatever. But that's what we also have like analysts for. That's their job. We don't rely on a startup's definition of competitive analysis to solely determine whether we think it's competitive or not. Unless you literally have a gun to your head and you're like in one of those like 5-minute judging competitions where you can't possibly know the industry, you know, every nuance of the industry. Sure, you take them at face value, but in all other circumstances, you kind of don't. So the competitive analysis really is a glimpse into the founder's psyche and how they perceive threats, how they perceive their own strengths, and whether they have tunnel vision or not.
Let's take an example, right? Like CGM. So a bunch of startups are like trying to use this, using existing tech, and to help people, make sure that, what do you say?
Blood sugar is controlled. Yeah. Under control.
Is under control. So then I was thinking of like the threats these companies could face. One is, so like you said earlier, in non-invasive tech could show up, and then it's not like these guys are building the tech or has a lot of R&D money to come up with that tech. That's one thing. And then also we talked about Fitbit and Apple. So those guys already have the distribution in place. So these could be huge threats, right? So you're talking about non-direct competitors like this.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'd worry about Apple and Samsung.
Yeah.
Right. In a CGM sort of offer. I wouldn't worry about say, oh, we have to compete against Abbott or Dexcom. It's really Samsung and Apple.
Yeah.
Because one of the challenges, like the Abbott of the world, they already hold this medical segment. You know, the doctors are really keen. And then you might have Apple and Samsung come in with something where it's like, yeah, okay, Apple Watch next version. We can now kind of directionally tell whether your glucose is going up or down. All right, that's super useful. And it's going to be useful for people that want to be, you know, the worried well or performance athletes or maybe mild diabetics who, you know, can't be bothered to like prick their fingers every 6 hours. And it'll be good enough. And then the problem is that's generation one.
Yeah.
So what do you think is going to happen in the next version? Oh, whoops, you've got an FDA.
Yeah,
which is exactly, you know, what happened with other biomarkers.
Yeah. So when you think about building a competitor deck, it's not just searching for people who do some similar stuff. It's also thinking about what could be like a potential threat to your business. It could also be like people not adopting your product, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a different kind of risk. That's a product market fit sort of risk as opposed to a competitive risk.
Yeah.
And it's funny, like when I think about, let's say, digital health records, you know, your competitor's paper, in a way, I wouldn't say that's a product market fit issue. I think it's an actual competitor. Like it's paper because you're so, that is the largest one out there, especially in this part of the world.
Yeah.
It's cheap. It works. You know where to find it. It serves your need. But long-term, broader picture, it's not all that useful, except to that individual doctor.
Yeah.
And even still, there's huge potential for errors.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other part I'd worry about is, what if, I don't know, what if we figure out a pill that just rewrites your insulin receptors so you don't have diabetes? And maybe it's cheap. That's kind of an out of left field sort of competitor, but that could be one. It's like, oh, crap, we found a cure for diabetes.
Yeah.
Then you're suddenly... Feel free to eat all the potato chips and cookies that you want, because insulin control is now fully being synthetic.
Yeah, that would be like a killer blow.
Yeah, I would love nothing more than to have a pill that lets me eat as many chips and cookies as I want.
So when a VC withdraws a term sheet by fundraising, who looks bad? Is it the VC that looks bad, or the startup looks bad?
I think it depends. I think it depends on the circumstances by which the term sheet was withdrawn. I think it also depends on how you handle that withdrawing process and whether you're still on good terms with the startup. Because look, you can write a term sheet under certain preconditions. It's like, okay, we want these three things to be done. If they're not, then we can't proceed with the investment. You know, usually, and it also depends on the philosophy of the VC, because if you're a VC who, you know, meets a startup for the first time and you're like, okay, I love what you're doing, here's the term sheet, right? Versus a VC who's just done 3 months of due diligence on that startup and then writes a term sheet. there's a different level of expectation that comes with term sheet, depending on whether you do it pre or post diligence, right? I also think that if you walk away from a term sheet for no good reason as a VC, that is bad behavior. Or if you are holding on to a term sheet to increase your optionality or your ability to negotiate with a startup, then ultimately it fails, you're a jerk. You just wasted everyone's time. And unfortunately, startups don't have a lot of time, especially if they're coming to the end of their runway. So that makes the VC look really bad. Now, none of this can be gleaned from, oh, this VC walked away from a term sheet. It's really the context and discussions that happen around this. And look, startups talk, and so do VCs. Everyone talks. There are like very few secrets in this world, as much as we want to kind of say there is. You know, I've seen a lot of things I shouldn't have seen, but you know, and I'm sure stuff is being spoken about us that we would not feel comfortable disclosing publicly either. I mean, it's just a matter of fact. But the thing that we always try to operate by is we always want to do the right thing and always treat the founder's time and effort with respect. And I think that if we can just always do that, then 99% of our problems won't exist.
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, the job of a VC is very similar. You know, when startups have to fundraise from VCs, VCs has to fundraise from LPs. So it's kind of, they should know what it feels like, right? But really, like I have seen a lot of founders talk about this, It really pisses founders off when a term sheet is withdrawn, no matter what the circumstances.
Well, yeah, because they need money or else they wouldn't be raising. And that just increases the urgency to solve this money thing to 11, you know, out of 10. So that's exactly it. So I think, again, you just have to be really transparent along the entire process, because sometimes, look, it doesn't work. You've got three conditions. Maybe you needed to have a local investor or something come on board before you are able to conclude the deal. Maybe you have something in your LP agreement that says, like, we cannot invest in something unless these conditions are met. And those are cast in stone. And so as long as you make that clear,
yeah,
then that's all you can really do. And if you're really worried about walking away from term sheets under any circumstance, well, don't invest. Don't be an investor.
Yeah. But I think that there is a communication gap sometimes. Like, I mean, sometimes it could be like a due diligence failure also, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So again, just you got to be transparent.
Yeah.
And you got to make sure that the lines of communication are open. And okay, sometimes I can think of some circumstances where it's like you see something so fundamentally wrong, and it's really difficult for you to communicate it to the founder, you might chicken out and just give a generic excuse.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that I can think of, but I would hope that those sorts of things would emerge well before the topic of term sheet comes up. And, you know, it hasn't happened to us yet. Maybe it will one day. Maybe we figure out one day that the founder is less... let's say they had certain political allegiances that we'd considered extremely improper. But, you know, how do you bring that up in a conversation? Yeah. Like, let's say they're like, I don't know, a right-wing white nationalist or something like that. Like, how do you bring that up in conversation? Obviously, you can't invest in that. But how do you bring it up in conversation? Like, I don't know. I have not, thankfully, have never had to deal with that yet.
Yeah. VCs can easily come up with a generic answers, like maybe due diligence failed or something like that.
Yeah, it's like, we don't believe in your business model.
Yes.
No, but honestly, you can, after a while, a founder can kind of read BS excuses.
Yeah.
I mean, I see it as well when some of my founders are raising from other VCs and you see the excuse that they gave and it's like, really? Really? Is that the excuse? You could have figured that out in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah. So I think that's what pisses the founders off more than, you know, the fact that you're not getting the money, because you know, they committed and then they are, it's like taking your word back, right? Kind of thing. I know it's not legal, but yeah. And
yeah, exactly. And I think, again, if you can just say or do what you say and say what you do, that'll cover most of your issues.
Yeah.
Now, this could be, you know, my relative inexperience as an investor. I've only been doing this for 7 years. So maybe it's not enough. And as a VC for almost 4 years. So who knows, maybe I just haven't seen enough deals.
So what were some of the biggest challenges, you know, for you to raise your fund?
and some of the lessons, the biggest lesson that you've learned through that process?
Yeah, number one, I've never been a VC before. Full stop. That was probably the hardest thing to convince people to invest in our fund when none of us have ever worked in VC. That number one. Number two is we wanted to raise a small fund. And that's actually, I think, more difficult than raising a big fund. Yeah. Because you exclude a lot of different kinds of investors when you go for a smaller ticket size. However, that's what I felt comfortable with. And it also allowed us greater freedom in decision-making. So if we're going to do a good job, then we want to have entire responsibility for that. And if we do a bad job, we don't want to be able to blame anyone else for our failures.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, one of our founding principles.
So one thing about not being an investor, right? So everyone keeps mentioning that, you know, your past performance is not a guarantee of future performance. Then why do LPs True. Care? Yeah.
Everyone says that, but they don't mean it. I've almost never met anyone who ignores past performance, right? And you have to take a big risk to invest in someone who doesn't have a past performance. And in fact, the way that we overcame that challenge is, yeah, we could use our angel investing track record to a certain extent, but we also were fundraising and deploying capital at the same time. So those who really trust us, well, they're the first ones to give us money, right?
Yeah.
And then we used that money to invest into startups and they did what they said they were going to do. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
And we used that momentum to be able to raise more money.
Yeah.
And so by the time we closed our fund, we had nine investments already.
So some lessons learned.
Yeah. It's not about getting to yes, it's getting to no. I think that is a number one lesson that I would take away from all of this.
Yeah.
All investors want optionality. And saying no closes that optionality. Whereas if you say, oh, I'm interested. Yeah, keep me posted. Yeah, let's meet again in 2 months or let's catch up. And the optimistic fundraiser, the founder, all that positive bias is going to be like, oh, that person's really interested. Okay, well, I'll keep feeding them more information. Great, let's do that. Let's keep doing it. And what that does is it keeps 300 conversations going, which probably shouldn't have been kept going.
Yeah, and it sounds
like... And if I do a kind of a retrospective analysis on all the investors that came into our fund, the vast majority went from first meeting to money in bank within a month.
Yeah, those are people who are really convinced about what you're doing. Yeah, I mean, only yesterday I recorded another podcast where we discussed the exact same thing. Getting to know is a very, very important thing. Because otherwise, investors, whether it's startups trying to raise from VCs or VCs maybe trying to raise from LPs,
yeah.
A lot of investors like to keep conversations hanging and not close.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that probably is a good lesson is understanding product market fit. So we designed our fund to what we thought founders needed. But founders are not our only customer. Yeah, if we're not attractive to founders, we won't ever get into any deals or any good deals. But at the same time, we also needed to design something that was taking into consideration investor preferences. Sometimes those are impossible. A lot of investors like liquidity. Well, sorry, this is a VC fund. You know, your money's gone for a decade, right? And if you're lucky, you'll get more of it back than what you put in, hopefully a lot more. You know, that's something you can't design around. Other things you can't really design around are management fees. Like you need to pay yourself, you need to pay your staff, you need to pay expenses. So you can't really have too much play around that. Carried interest, that's something that's also really difficult to maneuver around. But what you can control is, you know, what role do you want to play? Your investment thesis, your size of ticket, your size of fund, you know, how many companies you want to have. So all those sorts of things are variables that are flexible. And when you design it just for one party, then it puts you in a little bit of a risky situation where you might exclude a lot of other investors that could have been your investors because you had a certain thesis or a certain construction. So I think a lot of investors didn't like the fact that we're global. Would I go back and change this? No, absolutely not. But a lack of awareness in the potential variables that investors may take into consideration was something that, you know, took a while to get. And I think it would have saved us a lot of pain and a lot of unnecessary conversations if we just kind of knew this at the start. So I do feel a bit better about doing this again by raising a second fund. Certainly, like from fund one, we knew nothing when we started, other than what we thought was a good idea and how to write a check.
Yeah, but you know, if you were to do this again, also, you still would want to define clearly, like, what is it that you want to do, right? In terms of the stage and then the kind of startup that you want to back. I mean, you can't really base it on what LPs want, right? You definitely would want to position yourself as like, how am I going to add value to a particular set of startups?
Yep. Yeah. So if I were to do this again, I probably would have gone after first generation money much earlier, because they're the ones who actually really liked our thesis in general, because they were close enough to the problem as senior executives in healthcare or in consulting, successful founders themselves. We spent a lot of time speaking to family offices, which really, you know, a lot of the times the people managing the money don't own the money. It's not their money. So they're not incentivized to really take any risks, because they're, you know, as long as they kind of return a little bit above the market and are nice people to work with, chances are you keep your job. But you make some bad decisions where, let's say, your investment goes down or gets written off, then that's a quick way to lose your job.
Yeah. Oh, so this is very interesting. So essentially, how would you go about doing this? So you would want to, say, position yourself in a particular way to a segment of startups, and then figure out the LPs that would fit that? That would be the approach?
I think it really depends on the fund manager. It really depends on how tightly bound are you to your thesis. Like, how much do you believe in your thesis versus how much do you want to get assets under management? Because certainly, if you're more flexible on the thesis side, you can raise money faster, probably, and from a wider group of people. Now, the risk of that is, because you haven't defined your thesis clearly, you may have a variety of expectations from your investor base. So guaranteed, unless you're knocking it out of the park, you're going to have some unhappy LPs.
Yeah, for sure. And why a small fund? So when you raise a small fund, management fee and the resources that you have is also less. So why a small fund?
A small fund because, well, at the time, it was only me and a piece of my partner in Taiwan. So we had a bandwidth issue, right?
Yeah.
We knew the problem and the unmet need was really in the first or second stages of fundraising. So that said that, okay, we're going to deploy $250,000 to $500,000. Okay, all right. Let's say it's average of $500,000. How many companies can you manage at $500,000 a pop, right? And if you have a $100 million fund, that's 200 companies. Can you, as an individual, manage 200 companies? I can't manage 200 of anything.
Yes.
Right? So that's a non-starter. And then the thing is, with follow-on financing, that was a deliberate decision, because we saw the greatest unmet need in that earlier stage, and we wanted to get enough of a portfolio theory to make sure that we have like sufficient breadth. And there was no guarantee, because we were first timers, that we're able to raise enough of a fund that also provide follow-up funding for that as well. So it's not like if we have, you know, 7.5 million or whatever, that you'd want to use 3 to write your first tickets and then save the rest for follow-on. That you might pick the wrong 6 companies. Whereas if you're able to deploy to 12 companies or 18 companies, then you have a greater chance of getting one of them that does really, really well, or at least have a greater number of them that are able to generate more of the returns. Because it's asymmetric distribution, right? If you invest $500K in something, the most you can ever lose is $500K. That's your floor.
Yeah.
However, the most you can ever make, you know, could be $5 billion.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of those investments need to work really, really well.
Yeah, or just even a couple of them returning 5x or 6x is more than enough to get you in the top quartile of venture returns.
Yeah.
So I think that's it. And it's really personal decision. It's really, what are you comfortable with? Would I have personally been comfortable with $20 million as a first time fund manager? No, I wouldn't have.
Yeah, you also want your... test yourself and then get a feel of it, no, before taking on bigger and bigger chunks of money.
Yeah. So would I be more comfortable with it now after doing it for 4 years and investing in 14 companies? Yeah, probably.
Yeah. So you've made some investment in a startup that's working on respiratory health. So both infectious and non-infectious. And so I'm really interested in the non-infectious part. So how big is that problem? And then what are the challenges in solving this problem? Because...
Well, it's certainly a top four.
Yeah.
If you look at cost drivers in the US, as an example, it is certainly one of the top four, COPD in particular. And the consequences of not treating it are pretty awful, right? So we invested in the company I think you're referring to is Vigor Medical Systems. Yeah. That does COPD management, and a handheld spirometer, clinical grade, is at the core of this technology.
Yeah.
They're also launching in India.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. And hopefully they're able to bring solid respiratory management of serious chronic respiratory diseases to the masses. It is again a huge problem. I think one of the biggest shocks, like after I moved to Singapore in 2014, like a week later, the sky turned black and it smelled like barbecue.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. What's that? Yeah, haze, exactly. So that was one thing. And of course, I've been going to China for almost every year since 2004, 2004, pre-COVID. Yeah, I saw various colors in the sky. Now they've made wonderful progress in cleaning things up in the past couple of years, but still, like the PM2.5s, PM10s were off the charts. And it's not like Indonesia where your pollution is very organic. This was like industrial heavy metals in addition to, you know, dinosaur juice, right?
Yeah. So it's the same in a lot of emerging markets like India. And the problem is, you know, so people think, it's fog in the morning. People still think of smog as fog. They don't realize that this is a big problem. So, I mean, that's why I particularly wanted to ask, because this is an invisible problem, right? It's not like you're getting constant feedback that something's happening to you.
Yeah. Well, it's invisible until you go somewhere where it doesn't exist, then you come back home.
Yeah. Then you feel
it's terribly shocking when you realize that, oh my God, this is what I was breathing on a day-to-day basis. And you're right. It doesn't, unless you're one of the really unlucky ones and really get respiratory conditions from an early age. I actually did. You know, I actually have, you know, chronic bronchitis due to air pollution when I was exposed as a kid. You know, it's you know, you find out too late. And there's honestly not a lot you can do unless you can control the air either internally or externally. What you can do is, you know, when you do have, like, if you are unlucky enough to have the disease, you can monitor your respiratory state and lung function so that you know that if you're going to have an exacerbation, a flare-up, that you can at least medicate or remove yourself from the irritants, you know, maybe days before that would happen, and then you avoid a trip to the hospital.
Yeah. But, I mean, more important problem to solve is the awareness itself, right? I mean, a lot of people don't even understand such a thing exists.
Yeah, so that's a big issue. I don't know if it's the health system's responsibility in its own, or is it public health, or is it government, or is it industry? Like, I don't know who takes the responsibility. I suspect it's going to be different in each country. But at the same time, if you feel like it's a problem that no one can take care of anyways, why agitate the population? I could see some stakeholders thinking like that.
I mean, the one way I think about raising awareness is, like, if you can get everybody to wear a mask, you know, even after COVID, then you're everybody is aware that there is something wrong.
Yeah.
Right. And sometimes it's just the location of the location and even the wind patterns, all this affect the pollutants, right?
No, it's true. And actually here in Singapore, we do have a national haze monitor, and we are warned when, you know, the air pollution's really bad.
Yeah.
And then we take appropriate measures, but you do have to have the infrastructure and the willingness of the decision makers to institute such a system.
So is it because of your personal condition that you have a special interest in investing in respiratory health, or?
No, actually, it's just one of the leading killers of people. And so we're going after these really big problems. And, you know, respiratory was one of them. Respiratory is great. You know, well, not great, but I mean, it's a great problem, as in great as in size, not great as in good thing, by all means. Alzheimer's is another big one. Oncology is a big one. Cardiovascular and metabolic, those are really, really big ones as well. So it just came up as an opportunity that we could address it both from the infectious disease angle and from the chronic disease angle. And we think that the two technologies we invested in are not competing with each other, but are rather complementary with one another.
How can we make sure that, you know, COVID is the last pandemic?
It won't be. And there's no way that we can prevent another one from coming up. It's a question of how do we respond to it in a more intelligent and a faster way. And that's a whole of government, whole of society task. Not one thing in isolation is going to totally take care of it. And I do hope we learned our lesson, though, because we got lucky. Because COVID, as horrible as it was, didn't kill all that many people compared to the plague of Justinian.
Yeah. But in a way, so the more infectious viruses are also, I mean, it affects you more, right? So then you're bedridden and then you're less likely to spread. So it's when you have these symptomatic and less symptoms that you become, you can spread faster, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's also that element of it. So where I'm from, we had this thing called Nipah a couple of years
ago. Yeah, Nipah virus, biosafety level 4.
Yeah, so that's deadly infectious. You know, 19 people who got it, 70 of them died. But then you only, it's not very infectious, as in like, it's only through close contact, right?
Yeah. No, it makes sense. It's fluid, just like Ebola. So Nipah and Ebola are both kind of these like level 4 horrible hemorrhagic fevers. Yeah. Think Hanta virus as well. But imagine if that was airborne, it would rip through people pretty quickly. But as a consequence of ripping through people really quickly, you could take some pretty drastic and short-lived measures. Yeah. And actually, HIV is the extreme tail end where it can take 20 years for HIV to turn into AIDS. And then, you know, it kills you. But imagine if HIV was airborne and it took 20 years to incubate. That's like potentially an extinction level event.
Yeah. So right? you mentioned we can't prevent the next pandemic, but then how can we do things better? So maybe we can...
Well, certainly we have to be more open with each other. We have to be more transparent with what we find. I think that's number one. Number two, governments need to restore trust in their people, from their people, sorry. Because if you're questioning the government's directives, you're not going to take the necessary precautions to halt the spread. And one thing that governments have to do is they can't bullshit their people. You should be transparent. It's okay to say we don't know yet, but we're working on it. In the meanwhile, we think this is what you should be doing. And we think this is what you should be doing based on the top advice of, you know, these scientists who've been, you know, working in this field for their whole lives, or clinicians or whatever. But who knows? I'm not a politician. Maybe this is not the right thing to do. But I think that building trust and being transparent with your populations probably is on the better side as opposed to being completely silent about it. And then sharing data with whoever can make a positive difference in trying to stop this. There's some basic stuff we can do infrastructure-wise is make sure that every single source of air is, you know, HEPA filtered, right? That's expensive, but with Wright's Law, who knows? Maybe if you make 100 times more HEPA filters, it'll be, you know, 200 times cheaper. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then have biosurveillance, have the ability to just randomly sample and sequence stuff that's floating around in the air if you really are paranoid about stuff, so you can identify interesting new things ahead of time. Decentralized vaccine making, decentralized PPE manufacturing is also something that could act as a rapid response. You saw how quickly Moderna was able to come up with a COVID vaccine. It took 2 days from sequence to first candidate. So if you have a platform that is already safe and tolerated and you know works, and you have manufacturing decentralized and appropriate stockpiles of raw materials, then you can actually do something about it quickly. But we'll see. I mean, this is all like theoretical, and I hope that it won't be theoretical if there is ever another pandemic. And I see that there are efforts to decentralize the supply chain.
So this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Well, thanks so much, Rahul, for having me, and keep in touch. Let me know how things go, and I'm sure we'll cross paths again soon.
If you like this podcast, please follow Understanding VC wherever you're listening to this, and also share it with folks who might be interested. Thank you.